Okay. So we are, if you're visiting with us, we're studying Esther. So we've come to chapter 7. We actually made it down into 7 just a little bit. But you remember that now the second banquet has taken place. And that was the arrangement of Esther herself. The king wanted to know what was troubling her and what she wanted. And so she said, come out to a banquet and I'll request it. And he did. He, of course, invited Xerxes and Haman. And then she changed her mind and didn't tell him what she wanted, but requested to have another banquet. And then she would reveal it to him. And there's different opinions about why she did that. A lot of commentaries will say that she was just being strategic. Others that she just didn't feel like it was the right time. And, you know, sometimes you feel that when something like this is a big deal, what she is about to do. This is her fulfilling the words of Mordecai telling her to go before the king and to intercede for the people. Now, she did that originally when she went into his private quarters, of course, risked her life doing that. He held out, of course, the golden scepter and showing that she found favor in his eyes. So this is actually the third time when he's going to be asking her, what is it that I can give you? I'll give you up to half the kingdom. And that really wasn't literal, but he really wasn't going to do that. But it just meant I'll be very generous to you. And so this is the third time, and we're going to see that she did tell him what she was requesting. I think we got to that last week. But look at the very beginning again in chapter 7 at verse 1. So the king and Haman went to the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, remember we pointed out that this really was his opportunity to change course. If he was ever going to do it, this was his time to repent and do whatever he could to rectify this terrible situation. Because the road that he's traveling, the path that he's going down, is not going to prevail. And his wife and his friends try to tell him that. You remember going back into chapter 6 there at the last part. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. And so that's them really telling him, you need to go a different way. You need to change course because you cannot prevail against Mordecai. But he's prideful and stubborn, and he's not listening. He's feeling pretty good now. Again, they've been at this second feast a whole day. They've been whining and dining, and everything is cozy. He's probably feeling comfortable. He's probably thinking, yeah, you know, I had kind of a rough stretch right there and I was very much embarrassed, but we're kind of back on course now. Here I am at this banquet, just me. For the second time, I'm the only one invited to be in the presence of the king and his queen. And so at the end of the day, the Jews are still going to be destroyed. And so things are pretty good. And he's, you know, sometimes that's what happens. When evil people aren't punished right away, they grow overconfident. And they begin to think that they have gotten away with something. There's a passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Turn over there. Just for a moment, Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and at verse 11, it kind of speaks to this truth. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 and at verse 11, the record says there, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. And by the way, this is the one thing I have against capital punishment in this country. I'm not opposed to capital punishment. It was God's law. And so we know it's morally right because God doesn't do anything immoral. And it was his idea. But the way we do it, you know, people sitting on death row for 20 years, that doesn't work, does it? And anyway, and that of course isn't what this is, but the principle is that when someone is doing evil, and if they feel like they're getting away with it, then they get comfortable in that. Here's a spiritual example of that. Turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. You remember what Paul said about how it's going to be when Jesus comes back? The world will be filled with people like this. First Thessalonians chapter 5 and at verse 3, it says, while people are saying there is peace and security, and we know what this is talking about. We know the context. If we didn't, we can conclude, boy, this is talking about Haman. Because he kind of, you know, he's feeling, oh, everything's good. Have peace now. I'm back in a secure situation. And watch, there is peace and security. Then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. Yeah, that describes Haman's situation. Like, just like that, he's going to find here momentarily, he's going to find himself just in a terrible situation. Destruction is going to come very swiftly. But right now, he's feeling pretty good. And so he doesn't repent. Like, this is his very last chance to fix this situation. And as I said last week, I'm not 100% sure he can do anything, that it's even fixable. But he could at least try. Like, just doing what he's doing. Again, they warned him, you're not going to prevail. You're not going to overcome. You've already begun to fall to Mordecai. And that's the way it's going to end up. But again, he doesn't do anything. So he's just there. They're having a good time. And then the second day arrives. And so the king says to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. And as we saw, she took that very wisely. She kind of broke that down into two responses. She says, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. And so, again, I'm more convinced than ever as I continue to read and study this, that she knows exactly what she's doing, as she first refers to herself here. And you know, this would be an absolute shock to the king, because he was not expecting this as a request. And you'll notice in his response, and then she mentions her people after she talks about her own life, and of course, this would be a shock to him as well, particularly the way she words it. She says, and I and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. And those are the exact words of the decree. And so Xerxes, now, you know, Xerxes may not, that had to be familiar to him as he heard those words. They may have been vague in his mind a little bit. Because you'll remember, he was kind of manipulated into writing this thing. And so he probably did it quickly without reading everything through, you know, the unintelligent thing to do when you're given something, some legal thing to sign is, you know, you don't read it. You just kind of, put your signature on where the X is. And that probably he did something like that. Haman, on the other side, he wrote the thing. So can you imagine as she is talking and she talks about her being destroyed and then her people being destroyed, and then she uses these three terms that are the same terms of the decree. I can guarantee you Haman knew exactly what was going on. And when he heard that, you can imagine him just freezing. You know, could it be? This can't be happening. like he's finding out. By the way, she doesn't reveal this at all, but he, just like the king, is finding out that she's a Jew. And so that's a big problem for Haman. And so he says, if she goes on to say, if we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. She's very, very crafty, and she's being very smart here, the way she's wording everything. Like that's a clear exaggeration there. You know, I mean, you know, basically, I think I told you last week from the NIV, basically, she's saying, if it was just a matter of slavery, I wouldn't waste your time. It's not worth disturbing you. Well, really? Do you think her and all of the Jews going off into slavery was an issue worthy of bringing it to the attention of the king? Yeah, sure it was. And she knew that. And he would know that. But he would also understand, you know, she is just being a very submissive, very obedient, respectful wife. And by the way, you can just add that to one of the other things we can compliment her about. She was a good wife, even though, one of the things, we probably haven't brought this out enough with her. And what their relationship was. We know that he was obsessed with her, attracted to her. He certainly did. I've been saying several times, he loved her the best he could. You know, I mean, he wasn't programmed to love the way at least the New Testament teaches us to love, husbands to love their wives, and, you know, that to have agape love. Agape love itself is a reasoned thing. It's not an emotion. He has a lot of strong emotions for Esther. There's no question about that. He's affectionate towards her. Does he have agape love for, I don't know, in his present state and his environment, if it was even possible for him to have that. I'm not saying he couldn't make up his mind. He could, but he didn't and he wouldn't in his particular environment. And so you take all of that, and how does she feel towards him? You know, we're never really told, but he was, after all, a pagan king. And have I told you he's a nut? Like, he's a terrible king, and I think we brought out before, just so you have in your mind who it is, like, she is still, again, risking her life. And revealing that she's a Jew and all of this, you know, she's revealing to him, yeah, we've been married all these years, but hey, guess what? Did you know I was a Jew, not a Persian? And so, I mean, and this man was something. Like I think I should have brought it out way back when he went on that ill-advised campaign against Greece. And one of the things he did during that campaign, his people, I mean, he was completely and thoroughly defeated. His army was almost annihilated completely. But at one point, he wanted them to build a bridge across the Hellespont. And that was a little body of water that separated the Aegean Sea and the Marmara Sea. And you really couldn't do that. The sea was kind of rough. And you'd imagine that his architects or whatever would be telling themselves, we can't do that. I mean, that's not smart at all. That's not going to work. And then guess what happened? It didn't work. And the sea destroyed it. And then guess what he did? He executed his engineers. But that's not the worst of it. And this is the fact that he then ordered for the sea to receive 300 lashes. Like, for real. Can you imagine someone, just because he said to do it, taking a whip to the sea 300 times? Like, that's who she's dealing with. He was that kind of man. He had a friend he was real loyal to him. And so he gave him what would be equivalent to like over $1 million worth of gifts. And so they were real close. And the friend came up to him at one point and asked if his son could avoid going to war. You know, if he was in the army and, you know, can we pull him back so he doesn't have to go to war? And he cut his son in half and had his army march between the two pieces of his body. You think he had a screw loose here or there? He was a nut. This is the man. And do you think that Esther isn't aware of who her husband is? Of course she is. That's why I say I kind of lean with the group that says, you know, she kind of felt after the first banquet, she might not be the right time. I need to think about these questions, and because it's all on the line right here. She had to word it just right to convince him that Haman was evil. And remember, he had a real part in the whole thing, so she had to do it in such a way that he didn't feel like she was attacking him. And she did. That's pretty much the way it worked out. So, I mean, don't, you know, Esther, people want to emphasize in her day, she would have been looked at like someone with beauty and no brains, but she had a whole lot of brains. She was smart. She was smart and crafty, and she knew exactly what she was doing with all of this. But so here we are, and all of this has taken place, but she hasn't revealed until she never does reveal that Haman doesn't know she's a Jew. So why is that important? Because when Xerxes hears all of this, he's red hot. He's thinking conspiracy. He's embarrassed. He knows once this comes out that he was tricked into signing this decree, and that he pulled one over, and the one who pulled one over on him was his favorite man. I mean, he elevated him up to the second spot in all the kingdom. And when you do that as a king, it's kind of embarrassing that you misread someone so much. And then to find out that he has conspired against my wife. You notice the question, who is he? The king Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he? And where is he who has dared to do this? Like, who had the audacity to threaten my wife, to want to kill my queen? Where is this fella? And he's very angry about this. And so and then, of course, she answers, and she doesn't hold back. No more do we see a woman who is a little bit timid or anything like that. She's in full force right now against Haman. So she says that then Esther said, a foe in an enemy. Like, you could, if you're Haman, he's probably already just shaking. I mean, he knows what's going on, but he hasn't been named yet, but he recognizes, uh-oh, she's a part of the people that I'm have got the king to agree to exterminate here. She's a Jew. And so then he hears her say, I'll tell you who it was, who the man is, a foe in an enemy, this wicked Haman. And then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Like, he knows right then it's over. He is a dead man. Unless the only chance he possibly has is if he can somehow get Esther, who is a Jew, who he is an enemy of, somehow get her to have mercy on him. Like, that's the only shot he has. He has no other chance other than that. And as it turns out, he hears, the king hears this, and it says at verse 7, and the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. There are so many different things that are ironic going on here. But can you imagine that the king, don't forget, this is the most powerful man probably in the world at this time. And you see him, he's so mad he can't even talk. He gets up and he leaves the room in his anger. And if you're Haman, you know that anger is directed at you. Like you, he realizes, I am probably not going to see the sunrise again unless I can somehow get Esther on my side, at least plead for mercy for me. And so he now begins to beg her for mercy. And when you think of again, just so ironic that what got him in all this mess in the first place? Huh? Who said that? Because you're right, if I heard you. Pride. Pride. But it demonstrated itself just because Mordecai wouldn't bow down and pay homage to him. And it made it worse when you know, he was told at the time, oh, he's a Jew. And he's a Agagite. He hates the Jews. And now look at him. Look at him now. Before, he's all upset because a Jew wouldn't bow to him. And now here he is finding himself bowing down to a Jewish woman. And we're not told exactly what he did, but he's begging for his life. And so it says, and the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. So clearly, he was going over, he's begging for his life, and the way you do that, he was paying homage to her. He was bowing down to her. And somehow, when the king comes back in the room, it looks like his queen is under attack. So he very well could have laid hands on her. Not in a way that the king is thinking, but in a respectful way. It has been said she may have been, or he may have been kissing her feet even, because that wasn't uncommon then. But at least grabbing onto her, something, because he knows, I have to turn her. That wasn't going to be easy. So he's falling down upon the couch and about to beg for his life right when the king walks in. And the problem with all of that was, you just don't do that. Like, you don't, just like with the king, you do not ever just walk up on the queen. You don't ever get that. No one ever gets that close to the queen unless, you know, you might be walking, you might be having a conversation and the king has called you over and his queen happens to be standing there. You know, that's one thing. But you don't just walk up on the queen. Ever. Like, that's a capital offense right away. And the king comes in, he's not only walked into her space, he's falling down. It looks to him like he's falling down upon her, as if he's even attacking her. You know, he's angry, remember. Sometimes you don't see things just right when you're full of rage. And he might be thinking, uh-oh, you know, she spilled the beans on him, and I leave the room, and he's angry, and now he has the nerve in my own house to attack my queen. And so he articulates that, and watch what happens. It says, and the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? And the word left the mouth of the king. As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Like, everybody knows you do not do that. His guards or whoever, before the king could even get it out, they see now the same thing. They right away put something over his head and cover his face. Before he could even finish saying what he was saying, they were right on it. Like, that, no, you're a dead man. You walked up on the queen like that? And they just covered his head. And once you had the guards of a king put something over your head like that, the only thing that's going to save you now is a miracle from God. And God's not going to help him, is he? He's an enemy of God. And so he's in trouble, and it doesn't take long for things to develop. It's sort of interesting here. Notice this. It says, then they put this over his face, whatever it was, covered his face with something. And then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, when the king's eunuchs waited on him all the time, he said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai. And then he just throws in there, whose word saved the king, by the way, is standing at Haman's house. And again, more irony. More irony. I mean, it's really, you know what I think? When I read that, you think, first of all, how did Harbona even know about that? It seems like Haman was talking too much. Now, it could have been maybe his wife or maybe one of his advisors that started telling people why those gallows were made. But, you know, I think I'd probably lean towards Haman, because that's just who he was. You know, remember, he's on his way to the court's house. He just knows he's going to get the permission to have Mordecai put to death. After all, he's already talked the king into genocide with regard to a whole nation of people. How hard could it be to get one Jew killed? And so he's going there, and he could have, at least somebody, started telling people about these gallows and who it was that was going to be executed on it. And somehow Harbona knows that. So he says, hey, king, guess what? You know, they're going to execute him. They've covered his face and everything. And here's something real convenient. He built some gallows to kill the man, by the way, who saved the king's life. And what does Xerxes say? Yeah, he says, hang him on that. That'd do just fine. And what happened? So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. And so it's the end. The situation is not completely solved. We'll see that as we get into the next chapter, but it is the end of this particular enemy of the Jews. And as I've been saying, all kind of irony in all of this. And lessons to be learned. Like, one of the things we ought to learn in life is that we are going to reap what we sow. And if anybody ever learned that lesson, Haman did on this occasion. But it's a repeated lesson throughout the Bible. You remember, of course, that Jacob lied to his father. He killed an animal, lied, and tried to deceive the Isaac and with regard to Esau. And then what happened years later? Right. His own sons killed an animal and deceived him with the blood that it was Joseph. You reap what you sow. You think about Pharaoh. And you remember Pharaoh had all the little baby boy Jews killed in the Nile. What happened later? He and his army drowned, was destroyed in the Red Sea. And even before that, of course, his own firstborn died because of the plague. You reap what you sow. We give example after example. David stole another man's wife, committed adultery. Later on, his own son, Absalom, slept with some of his concubines. And it's not just an Old Testament principle. You remember in Galatians, Paul makes, again, a spiritual application of this that really brings it alive to all of us even today. Galatians chapter 6 and at verse 7, Paul reminds us, Galatians, the 6th chapter, and at verse 7, he says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that he will also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. But the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life." Question is, how are you living your life? Because spiritually, you will reap what you sow. I'm going to reap what I sow. You live a half-committed life to God, wishy-washy kind of life, not serving God the way you should. You're going to reap what you sow. You're going to reap corruption. Give your life to God and walk after the Spirit. Walk in step with the Spirit. You're a faithful child of God. You're not perfect because none of us are. You sin from time to time, but you do your very best to serve God. You're going to reap eternal life. Not a might or maybe. You're going to, because we reap what we sow. And that's true physically. Most of the time, that's true physically. It's always true spiritually. And again, nobody learned that more than Haman. You can see him overseeing the building of these gallows again. His main nemesis is going to be impaled on these gallows. And guess who ended up being impaled? Haman himself, on the very gallows he had built. Pretty ironic when we stop and think about it. All right, but again, the crisis isn't over. And so we'll get in more. We'll start here, but the second bell will ring here directly, and we'll get into chapter 8. All of that really is the climax of the story. And so we'll take one more class on this and look at 8, 9, and 10 very quickly. 10 only has three verses to it. But there is still some business that has to be taken care of here. We know, okay, so Haman's taken care of. But what's still out there? The decree, right? The edict is still out there. So the Jews are still in trouble. And this is very much troubling Esther. So it says in verse 1, chapter 8, "On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai," that's very interesting. That was common to do that sort of thing. But just, again, more irony here. But particularly because of what she does with it that we'll read here in just a second. But first it says, "And Mordecai came before the king for Esther had told what he was to her." And you can imagine this, that telling her husband, "This man who saved your life, he's my cousin. But he's more than my cousin. He's technically my cousin, but he's really kind of my dad. He raised me. I'm his adopted daughter." And so he hears all of that, and the king took off his signet ring, took the signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and he gave it to Mordecai. And what does that tell us? What now is Mordecai? Second in command. Whatever you want to call him. Prime minister, I've been calling him. Viceroy, whatever. He is the second in command. Do you ever want to know that God is in charge? This is the third time we have seen something like this happen, where Jews, mere Jews, who are hated by a lot of people, and there's always people in any kingdom, any foreign land where they are, who don't like them, but now a Jew once again is elevated to second in command. Providence of God. He has seen this thing through every step of the way. Even though he's never named in Esther, we've seen his footprints all over this book. And now he has his man, Mordecai, who is the second in command in the greatest kingdom on earth. That's the power of God. You don't think he still rules and reigns, is in control right now? If there's one overriding message from the book of Esther, it's the sovereignty of God. He's on his throne. He's still in charge. Always has been, always will be. And we can see that. So he's elevated. And then it says, "And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman." And so, I mean, this is the best living Mordecai has ever had. This means he's over his house completely, his whole estate. Remember back in chapter 5, he was bragging about how rich he was? He was. Guess what he had? A big house with a lot of property. And when you're giving someone's house like that, that meant everything. Servants, he had anything. Mordecai now is the second in command, and he is over the house that was previously belonged to Haman. And so what an elevation. And again, the man that he wouldn't bow down to and hated, now he's in this position. What do people do you think when Mordecai walks in the room? And guess what? The king didn't even have to tell him to do it. Because he was a lot better man than Haman. He didn't have to have a king's order. Just what you did. But what a change of a situation. But then we get into verse 3. And so we'll pick up there next week or somewhere around there next week. And you'll find Esther still very much troubled because there's still that decree out there. And we got to fix that somehow. And we'll see how that works out next week.